picture this. It's like 3 a.m.
Okay.
And the CEO of this buzzy tech startup is just wired on cold brew. He's staring at his phone, right? And he's typing out a tweet that says, just finalize the paperwork. The IPO is going to make early investors wildly rich. Get ready.
Oh, no.
Right? His thumb is hovering over the send button. And if he presses it, I mean, he isn't just making a late night boast. He is actively committing a federal securities violation that could, you know, derail his entire public offering.
I'd probably land him in a very uncomfortable room with the SEC.
Exactly. So before we jump into how to keep our fictional executives out of federal prison, a quick shout out. This deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full series 24 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. You can check it out at CertFuel.com.
It's good stuff.
It is. All right, so let's get into it. Today's mission, we are tackling Function 5 of the Series 24 exam.
The beast.
Yeah, investor disclosure materials. And the goal is, by the end of this conversation, this whole communications framework for a registered offering, it's not just going to be a list of rules you memorize. It's going to be a logical system you deeply understand.
Which, honestly, is the only way to actually pass this section of the exam.
Right.
Because the SEC's communications framework is arguably the most heavily tested and widely misunderstood area of securities law.
Yeah.
We are looking at the bedrock rules governing every single syllable, slide, video, term sheet, you know, whatever a broker-dealer or an issuer puts out into the universe during a deal.
Right.
If you just try to memorize the rules without understanding the paranoia driving the SEC, the exam questions will effortlessly tie you in knots.
And to prevent those knots, and you know, to keep this from turning into a super dry legal lecture, we're bringing in our recurring Series 24 study buddies.
Oh, I love these guys.
Yeah, if you've been following along, you know the cast. First, we have Frank the founder. So Frank is the overly caffeinated, aggressively optimistic CEO of a tech startup gearing up to go public.
Right.
Frank basically believes every thought he has is brilliant and belongs on the internet immediately.
Which is a personality type the SEC specifically designed its regulations to contain, by the way.
Exactly. Which is why Frank Hurt's company hired our second character, underwriter Ursula. She's the syndicate manager at a major investment bank. Her blood pressure is permanently elevated.
For good reason.
Right, because her full-time job is basically playing defense against Frank's worst impulses. And finally, out in the retail branches, we have broker Bob.
Good old Bob.
Yeah. Bob is a retail broker who barely skims his compliance memos, loves a good sales pitch, and really just wants to collect his commission.
Naturally.
So let's look at the ultimate fear driving the SEC when it comes to Frank, Ursula, and Bob. This entire framework is built to prevent one specific concept, right? Gun jumping.
Right. Gun jumping it's the regulatory equivalent of a cardinal sin. You have to remember, the Securities Act of 1933 was born out of the ashes of the 1929 stock market crash.
Right, which was just fueled by rumors and lies.
Rampant speculation, outright lies, exactly. So the SEC Ursi's fundamental philosophy is that investors should make financial decisions based on a cold, hard, factual document.
The statutory registration statement.
Yes. Gun jumping happens when an issuer or an underwriter bypasses that document and instead, you know, hypes up the stock, creating a frenzy of artificial demand before the actual facts are available.
So let's put a visual to this. Gun jumping is kind of like trying to sell a house by standing on the front lawn with a megaphone, right? Screaming at the neighborhood about how the plumbing is made of solid gold.
And the roof will last 1,000 years.
Right. You're whipping up a bidding war before the Zillow listing with the actual license inspection report is even published. You're just conditioning the market based on pure hype.
And the SEC refuses to let the market be conditioned by a megaphone. They established a very rigid timeline to force information through an approved filter.
Okay.
So before a registration statement is filed, the rule is zero offers. Once it's filed, you can't use non-conforming prospectuses. And finally, you cannot finalize a sale unless the final prospectus actually lands in the investor's lap.
Wait, let me stop you at the word prospectus, because I mean, if I ask an average person on the street what a prospectus is, they picture a 200-page booklet printed on absurdly thick paper that arrives in the mail and goes straight into the recycling bin.
Yeah, totally.
But the regulatory definition doesn't really care about the paper quality, does it?
Not at all. Hmm? Regulatory definition is aggressively broad.
Oh.
Under the statute, a prospectus is any written communication that offers to sell a security or confirms the sale of a security.
Any written communication?
Yeah, yes. And it is vital to underline the phrase written communication. This includes graphic communications. So an email is a prospectus.
Right.
A website is a prospectus. A slide deck is a prospectus.
Mm-hmm. Okay, listener, I want you to apply that definition right now. Direct question for you. Let's go back to our 3 a.m. scenario, right? Frank, the founder, fires off that 280-character text tweet from his iPhone. He says, buy our new IPO stock. It aches going to the moon.
Classic Frank.
Is that tweet a prospectus? Give it a second.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the answer is yes. It absolutely is.
And the exam writers love this exact scenario.
Right.
Because it preys on your common sense. Your brain tells you, well, a tweet cannot be a prospectus.
Right.
But the statutory definition is entirely content-based, not format-based. Did it contain an offer to sell a security? Yes.
Yep.
Was it written? Yes. Therefore, it is a prospectus.
Wow.
And because Frank's tweet doesn't contain audited financial statements, risk factors, and a use of proceeds section, it is a vastly non-conforming illegal prospectus.
So the ultimate takeaway here is that during a deal, if you write down an offer in literally any medium and it doesn't fit into a very specific SEC-approved regulatory box, you just broke the law.
You did.
So let's look at the life cycle of a deal. Starting at the very beginning, Frank hasn't filed any paperwork with the SEC yet. We are in what is called the pre-filing period.
Right.
The rule here seems simple, right? Complete and total silence. No oral offers, no written offers. Just shut up and draft the paperwork.
That's the idea.
But, I mean, Frank still has a company to run. He can't just take his website offline and refuse to speak to his customers for 6 months.
Right. And the SEC understands the reality of corporate operations. A company suddenly going dark actually alarms the market and disrupts normal business.
Makes sense.
So to bridge that gap between you must stay silent about the stock and you still need to sell your software, the SEC constructed specific exemptions called safe harbors.
Safe harbors, okay.
If you operate strictly within these safe harbors, you are shielded from gun jumping charges. We need to dissect the two most highly tested pre-filing safe harbors side by side.
Let's do it.
The 30-day shield and the WKSI safe harbor.
All right, let's start with a 30-day shield since this applies to almost everyone, including Frank, right? Because he's running a private, unseasoned startup prepping for its first IPO. How does a calendar act as a shield?
Well, the 30-day shield provides a bright line buffer. The rule basically states that any communication made by the issuer more than 30 days before the registration statement is officially filed is permitted.
Okay.
But it hinges on one absolute condition. The communication can make zero reference to the upcoming securities offering. Furthermore, the issuer has to take reasonable steps to ensure whatever they said isn't republished during that 30-day quiet window right before the filing.
Let's stress test that. So Frank sends out a press release 45 days before underwriter Ursula plans to file the S-1 paperwork. The press release just says, we just hired a new vice president of engineering and our new software update drops next week. Is Frank safe?
He is completely safe. That is standard corporate communication well outside the 30-day window, with no mention of stock.
But what if Frank just can't help himself? What if he adds one tiny sentence at the bottom of that exact same press release? Like, we can't wait to scale this new engineering team with the capital from our upcoming IPO.
He loses the shield entirely.
Wow, just from that.
Yep. That single sentence is an offering reference. The 30-day shield does not forgive casual mentions. If you reference the capital raise, you have stepped out of standard business operations and you're back on the front lawn with the megaphone.
So Frank really has to walk a tightrope there. Now, let's contrast Frank's situation with the WKSI safe harbor. WKSI, well-known seasoned issuer. Let's unpack that acronym. Who actually qualifies as a WKSI, and why do they get to play by a completely different set of rules?
So the SEC reserves WKSI status for massive, deeply established public companies. The baseline financial threshold is either having $700 million or more in public float.
Which means equity actively held and traded by the public, right?
Exactly. So $700 million in float, or having issued at least $1 billion in non-convertible debt over the previous 3 years. We are talking about the largest corporations in the world.
Got it. So Frank, the founder, with his private startup, is galaxies away from being a WKSI.
Worlds away.
Yeah.
And the regulatory logic here is rooted in the efficient market hypothesis.
Okay.
A massive company with a $700 million float is already covered by dozens of Wall Street analysts. They have been filing 10Ks and 10Qs for years. The market is completely saturated with data about them.
Right. There are no secrets.
Right. So because the market already knows everything about a WKSI, the SEC is far less terrified of them manipulating investors with a megaphone. Consequently, the WKSI pre-filing safe harbor allows these titans to make oral and written offers at any time before filing.
Anytime.
Anytime. They do not have a quiet period.
They can just bypass the silence rule entirely. That's huge. But hold on, listener. Let's see if you can spot the trap here. Direct question for you.
Oh, this is a good one.
Let's pretend Frank, his company, actually was a massive WKSI. If underwriter Ursula, his syndicate manager, picks up the phone 10 days before filing and calls a major hedge fund to pitch this WKSI's upcoming stock,
huh?
Is Ursula protected by the WKSI safe harbor? Let's give you a beat to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the answer is no. She just committed a massive gun-jumping violation.
This is one of the most brilliant traps the exam sets. The safe harbor explicitly states it protects the issuer only.
The issuer only.
It never protects the underwriter. Ursula does not have a $700 million float.
Yeah.
The SEC does not give underwriters a free pass to hype up a stock pre-filing, regardless of how big the client is.
Right.
And Ursula can't use the 30-day shield either, because her pitch inherently references the offering.
Okay.
Pre-filing, an underwriter's phone must remain firmly on the hook.
Let's push on Frank's side of things again, then. Frank isn't a WKSI. He's bound by the silence rules. But surely there has to be a way for a company to officially acknowledge that a deal is in the works without violating the law, right? Like, what if rumors are swirling and Frank just wants to confirm factually that they are planning an IPO?
He can do that using the proposed offering notice safe harbor.
Okay.
Also known as Rule 135. This is a highly restrictive, bare bones announcement. Frank is allowed to publish a notice that essentially says, we are planning to do a deal.
Just the facts.
Just the facts. The rule permits him to state the name of the issuer, the title and amount of the securities being offered, the general purpose of the offering, and the basic type of underwriting.
Okay, but if the rule strictly lists what he can say, my instinct tells me the exam is going to test what he cannot say.
Exactly.
What crosses the line from a bare bones factual announcement into illegal market conditioning?
Two specific items will destroy a proposed offering notice: naming the underwriters and stating an offering price or price range.
Let's dig into the logic there. Why does the SEC care if Frank tells the world that Goldman Sachs is underwriting his deal?
Because naming a prestigious underwriter is a form of hyping the stock. It signals quality and artificially boosts demand before the financials are available.
Ah, I see.
Same goes for the price. If Frank says, we are offering shares at $20, investors start anchoring to that number and making speculative calculations instead of waiting for the prospectus.
Right. They start doing math in their head.
Exactly. The notice must remain totally sterile. We will compare this directly to a tombstone advertisement later, because the rules completely flip. But for now, lock away the fact that a pre-filing notice cannot name the underwriter and cannot state the price.
And briefly, just to tie a bow on pre-filing, how does the SEC treat standard, everyday information releases?
It depends on the company's status. If a company is already a reporting issuer, meaning they are already public and doing a follow-on offering, they can continue releasing their regular factual information.
Right.
And they can also release regular forward-looking information, like earnings guidance, because the market relies on that cadence.
Sure.
But a non-reporting issuer, like Frank, doing his IPO, is only permitted to release regular factual information. Frank is entirely forbidden from releasing forward-looking projections before the filing because he has no track record of accuracy with the SEC.
All right, take a breath, stretch your legs, shake it out. The grueling pre-filing period is over. Ursula successfully tackled Frank every time he reached for his phone. They finalized the paperwork, printed it out, and slammed it on the SEC's desk.
Hallelujah.
Right. We are officially entering the waiting period. The registration statement is filed, but it is not yet effective. The SEC is reviewing it, and the moment that paperwork is filed, the entire communications framework shifts underneath our feet.
The shift is monumental. Pre-filing, both oral and written offers were banned. The moment the document is filed, oral offers are permitted. You can talk about the deal.
Okay.
However, the ultimate restriction remains. Sales are still strictly prohibited.
Wait, let me push back on this, because the logic here feels completely backward. I can pick up the phone, call broker Bob, and spend 2 hours verbally pitching him on why Frank's company is the greatest investment of the century.
Yeah.
But if I type up that exact same pitch, word for word, and email it to Bob, I've broken the law. Why does the SEC treat oral and written communications so differently?
It comes down to the permanence of the record and how retail investors consume information. An oral conversation is fleeting, it's fluid, but a written document carries a psychological weight of authority. It is a permanent record.
Interesting.
By statutory definition, a written offer is a prospectus. The SEC's bedrock rule is that once you file your official paperwork, You cannot distribute a non-conforming prospectus.
So the email is non-conforming.
Exactly. If you send a free form email hyping the stock, that email is an illegal prospectus. If you want to make a written offer during the waiting period, you cannot freestyle it. You must use an SEC-approved, highly regulated format. And the workhorse of this period is the preliminary prospectus, widely known as the red herring.
The red herring. I've always loved that name. It comes from the bold red text printed down the left side of the cover page that legally screams, "This document is not final. Do not give us money yet."
That's the one.
The red herring is essentially the Zillow listing we talked about earlier, but what is it missing?
So it contains the massive bulk of the business narrative, the risk factors, the audited financial statements, the management bios. What it intentionally leaves out is the final offering price, the exact underwriting discount, and the precise net proceeds.
Okay.
This is known as the pricing omitted mechanic.
But wait, if I'm handing an investor a document and asking them to evaluate a stock,
yeah.
Isn't omitting the price inherently deceptive? I mean, how can they evaluate it without knowing what it costs?
It's not deceptive. It's a structural necessity of capital markets. Huh. The final price of an IPO isn't determined months in advance. It's determined through a massive price discovery process during the waiting period.
Right.
Ursula is taking the red herring to institutional investors, gauging their interest and building a book of demand. If the SEC forced them to lock in a price at the time of filing, the market would break.
That makes sense.
The SEC allows the omission because the red herring's purpose is to educate the investor on the company so that when the final price is announced the night before effectiveness, the investor is fully informed to make a decision.
Okay, listener, let's see if you've got the rules of the waiting period. Lockdown. Direct question. Underwriter Ursula emails the red herring to broker Bob. Bob reads it, loves the financials, calls his best client, and pitches the stock. The client says, "I'm in, let's lock it down." Can broker Bob use the red herring to confirm the sale and take cash from his client's account right then and there? Mm-hmm. Think about it for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely not.
No way. Bob would lose his license. Sales are unconditionally prohibited until the SEC officially declares the registration statement effective. The red herring is purely a tool for making written offers and soliciting what are called indications of interest. An indication of interest is just a non-binding handshake. It says, "I might buy this if the price is right." The moment Bob takes actual cash, he violates the core prohibition of the Securities Act.
So the red herring is powerful, but it is dense. It dense 200 pages. What if Ursula doesn't want to email a massive PDF every time she talks to a hedge fund?
Yeah, nobody wants to read that on their phone.
Right. What if she just wants to send a crisp one-page term sheet that highlights the deal economics? Or what if Frank wants to record a slick 5-minute video of himself walking through the factory and email it to a select group of investors? I mean, these are written communications. They definitely aren't the red herring. Are they strictly illegal?
Historically, yes. Those would trigger massive gun jumping violations.
Really?
But the SEC eventually realized that modern finance moves too rapidly for everyone to rely solely on a 200-page book. So they created a modernized framework called the Free Writing Prospectus, or FWP.
FWP, okay.
An FWP is defined as any written offer made after the registration is filed that is not a statutory prospectus and not a simple tombstone advertisement. It allows for the exact free-form marketing you mentioned. Term sheets, sales memos, glossy brochures, and recorded video pitches.
But the SEC doesn't just hand out marketing freedom without wrapping it in red tape. What are the mechanical hurdles Ursula has to jump over to use an FWP legally?
The mechanics are non-negotiable. First, every single FWP must contain a prescribed boilerplate ADGR legend.
Okay, what does that say?
This legend essentially tells the investor, "We have filed a real registration statement. You should read it, and here's the link to find it."
Got it.
Second, the FWP must be officially filed with the SEC no later than the date of first use. You can't hide it from the regulators.
Right.
And third, the issuer and the syndicate members must retain a physical or digital copy of that FWP for 3 years from the date of the initial bona fide offering.
Let's apply this to the real world, specifically the recorded video pitch scenario, because this is a massive hunting ground for exam writers. Let's talk about the roadshow.
Oh, the roadshow.
Yeah. Ursula rents out a grand ballroom at the Ritz-Carlton. She packs it with 200 institutional investors. Frank, the founder, gets on stage, paces around with a microphone, and pitches the stock live. Does Ursula need to stamp an EDGA legend on Frank's forehead and file this event as an FWP?
No. A live in-person roadshow occurring in real time is classified as an oral communication.
Okay.
And since oral offers are fully permitted during the waiting period without filing requirements, Frank is free to pitch live to that room.
Okay, let's twist the scenario. Frank hates flying. So Ursula sets up a private Zoom call. Frank pitches live from his office, but Ursula decides to hit the record button on Zoom. Later that afternoon, she takes that video file, puts it behind a password-protected link, and emails it to 5 portfolio managers who missed the live call. What did Ursula just do?
Ursula just crossed a major regulatory tripwire. She created what the SEC defines as a graphic communication. Mm. The regulations explicitly state that all graphic communications, which include recorded webcasts, audio recordings, and video pitches, are treated as written communications.
Because she hit record.
Exactly.
Right?
Because she sent a written communication offering a security during the waiting period, she just birthed a free writing prospectus.
Wow.
She better make sure that video has the prescribed legend on the screen, and she better file that recording with the SEC immediately.
That is such a crucial trap. So live and in person, that's oral, no filing, recorded and emailed privately. That's graphic, which means it's written, which means it's an FWP, which means file EIT or fail. If she forgets to file it, she just distributed an illegal prospectus and ruined the IPO timeline.
Let's add the final nuance to that trap. The SEC offers an escape hatch based on accessibility.
Oh, really?
If Ursula takes that exact same Zoom recording and instead of emailing it privately, posts it publicly on Frank's corporate website, available to the entire world without a password or restriction, and she includes a hyperlink to the statutory prospectus right next to the video, then the SEC says she does not have to file it as an FWP.
Wait, let me make sure I understand the logic there. Why does making it public remove the filing requirement?
Because privacy triggers the regulatory filing duty. If you send a private recording to 5 wealthy guys on Wall Street, the SEC views that as a clandestine sales memo, and they demand a copy filed on their desk to ensure you aren't whispering illegal promises.
I see.
But if you post it on the open internet for every retail investor to see, it becomes part of the public domain. The transparency itself acts as the regulatory mechanism, so the formal filing duty is waived.
Incredible. So to lock down the roadshow trap, live is oral, no filing. Recorded in private is an FWP, must file. Recorded and totally unrestricted public access, no filing required.
Got it.
Now, we established earlier that not all companies are created equal in the eyes of the SEC. How does a company's status affect their eligibility to actually use these free writing prospectuses?
We need to pull up our side-by-side comparison again. Let's bring back the WKSI, the massive corporate titan, and contrast them with Frank, the unseasoned startup founder.
Right.
WKSIs and seasoned issuers, companies with massive public float and a long history of pristine SEC filings, can use an FWP at any time after the registration is filed. They can shoot out term sheets and emails freely, provided they follow the legend, filing, and 3-year retention rules.
What about Frank? I mean, he's a non-reporting issuer. The SEC barely knows his name.
And the SEC does not trust Frank with a blank marketing canvas. A non-reporting issuer cannot use an FWP immediately after filing. Frank has to wait until a preliminary prospectus that actually contains a price range has been filed.
Okay, that makes sense.
But the restriction goes deeper. Even when he gets that price range filed, Ursula can't just email Frank's slick new FWP by itself. For an unseasoned or non-reporting issuer, the rules dictate that the FWP must be accompanied or preceded by the most recent statutory preliminary prospectus.
So Ursula can't just attach the one-page term sheet to an email. She has to attach the massive 200-page red herring PDF to that exact same email to make it legal.
Correct. The regulatory logic is that the FWP is allowed to supplement the red herring, but it can never replace it.
Wow.
The investor must have immediate access to the full risk profile before reading the marketing highlights. And let's address the bottom tier, ineligible issuers.
Who are they?
If a company has recently failed to file their required SEC reports or just emerged from bankruptcy or has been convicted of a securities-related felony, they are completely banned from using an FWP. The privilege is revoked.
No free writing for felons. Makes sense. All right, we are halfway through the waiting period. Let's step away from Frank and Ursula for a moment. While they're grinding out roadshows and filing FWPs, what is happening in the broader ecosystem? What are the financial analysts doing?
A lot.
Let's look at how the SEC handles projections and independent research while a deal is in purgatory.
This is a critical tension point. The SEC wants a quiet, highly regulated period, but the capital markets still demand continuous information.
Right.
Let's look at future projections. When Frank files his S1, He naturally wants to include forward-looking statements.
Mm.
He wants to tell investors about his projected revenue growth, his plans to build a new factory, his expectations for market share.
But if I'm Frank's lawyer, I'm sweating. If Frank puts a projection in a federal SEC filing, and a year later a recession hits and he misses those projections, aren't the investors going to immediately sue him for putting a lie in the registration statement?
Oh, they absolutely will. The plaintiff's bar lives for missed projections. To prevent companies from being paralyzed by fear and refusing to share any future plans, the Securities Act contains a forward-looking statement safe harbor.
Okay.
This explicitly protects issuers from civil liability for their projections, but only if they satisfy two rigid prongs. The projection must be made in good faith, and it must rest on a reasonable basis.
Let's define those in the real world. Good faith means Frank actually genuinely believes the number. He isn't just pulling a massive revenue target out of thin air to pump the stock price.
Right. Good faith is the psychological intent. But intent isn't enough. The second prong, reasonable basis, is the empirical evidence.
Hmm.
When the SEC or a judge looks at that projection, Frank better be able to produce the internal spreadsheets, the market research, and the historical sales data that mathematically support why he believed a 20% growth rate was achievable.
So if he has pure faith but zero data, the safe harbor shatters. And if he has pristine spreadsheets but secretly knows a massive supplier just went bankrupt, meaning he's acting in bad faith, the safe harbor shatters. He must possess both.
Exactly. And this protection extends across the ecosystem. It applies to forward-looking statements, inside registration statements, and it also covers the continuous periodic reports, like a 10Q or a 10K.
Listener, guard your exam score right here. I'm going to show you how the test raters will try to trick you. Direct question. Frank writes the following sentence in his SEC filing. We expect that we grew our active customer base by 30% last quarter. Does the forward-looking statement safe harbor protect that sentence? Give it some thought.
Mm-hmm.
No, it offers zero protection.
Let's dissect why that fails. The safe harbor is exclusively for the future. The word expect is a decoy word designed to make the sentence look like a projection.
Yeah, because it says last quarter.
Right. Last quarter means the event has already concluded. A historical fact, dress up in a forward-looking costume receives absolutely no protection. You either grew 30% last quarter or you didn't. If you misstate history, you are fully liable.
Such a good trap. Now let's check in on broker Bob out in the retail branches. Bob's firm is not part of the underwriting syndicate. Ursula did not invite them to participate in Frank's IPO. Bob is just sitting at his desk reading the red herring, and he thinks Frank's tech company is the next big thing.
He loves it.
Yeah, he wants to write up a research report and mail it to his 500 retail clients saying this upcoming IPO is a massive buy. Does hitting send on that report put Bob in regulatory crosshairs?
Potentially, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Let's trace the logic. A research report is a written communication that recommends or offers a security.
Right.
Therefore, by definition, it is a prospectus. If Bob distributes a non-conforming prospectus during the waiting period, he is technically committing a gun-jumping violation.
Mm-hmm.
However, if the SEC prosecuted every independent analyst for writing about an upcoming IPO, independent research would evaporate. And the market would be less informed.
Well, so the SEC has to carve out a specific tunnel for Bob.
They did. It's called the Non-Participating Broker Research Safe Harbor, found under Rule 137.
Okay.
It allows Bob to publish his research without it being deemed an illegal prospectus, provided he operates within three strict guardrails. First, Bob and his firm cannot be participating in the syndicate or the selling group. They must have zero economic stake in the success of the offering.
Makes perfect sense. No conflict of interest. What's the second guardrail?
Bob must publish this research in the regular course of his business.
Meaning Bob's firm has to actually have a track record of covering the tech sector. He can't just be a municipal bond broker who randomly decides to become a tech analyst the week of Frank's IPO just to ride the hype wave.
Exactly. The SEC wants to see a historical pattern of publication, not a one-off hype piece.
Makes sense.
And the third and most lethal guardrail, Bob must receive absolutely no consideration, direct or indirect, from any deal party for publishing that report.
Okay, listener, direct question time. Bob passes the first two tests. He isn't in the syndicate, and he regularly publishes tech research. But Ursula is looking at her order book and panicking. The IPO lacks momentum. So she meets Bob for coffee and quietly slips him a $5,000 consulting fee to write a glowing 5-star report about Frank's company. What happens to Bob's safe harbor? Think about it.
Mm-hmm.
It instantly vaporizes, straight to regulatory jail for both of them.
Yep. The moment a single dollar of compensation flows from a deal party to the analyst, the safe harbor is irrevocably destroyed. And pay close attention to the phrase deal party.
Deal party, okay.
It isn't just the issuer. If Ursula pays him, if Frank pays him, or if an early venture capital investor trying to cash out pays him, the protection is dead. Bob's report instantly transforms into an illegal prospectus, and he is liable for a framework violation.
So Bob keeps his hands clean, the research gets published legally, and we finally reach the finish line of the waiting period. The SEC has reviewed the registration statement, they are satisfied with the disclosures, and they officially stamp it.
We made it.
The registration is declared effective. We have entered phase three, the post-effective period. The bedrock rule shifts one final time. We can finally sell the stock, but the actual delivery of the security must be preceded or accompanied by the final statutory prospectus.
And this final rule used to create one of the most absurd logistical bottlenecks in Wall Street history.
Oh, let's visualize the nightmare. Imagine Ursula successfully sells 10 million shares to thousands of retail buyers across the country. Under the old rules, before those electronic trade confirmations could legally settle in the client's accounts, Ursula's firm had to literally run printing presses, bind thousands of 500-page paper books, load them onto trucks, and ensure the Postal Service dropped physical copies into thousands of mailboxes.
It was a nightmare. The sheer volume of paper and postage was staggering. It was an archaic system operating in a digital world. So the SEC adapted and created a functional miracle known as access equals delivery.
I use this analogy all the time because it's so beautifully practical. Access equals delivery is like telling your department head, hey, the quarterly budget report is uploaded to the shared Google Drive, instead of printing out a 50-page slide deck, walking down the hall and dropping it on their desk. As long as it is uploaded to the server and they have the permissions to open it, you have fulfilled your duty to deliver it.
That is the exact mechanism. Under access equals delivery, once the issuer formally files the finalized statutory prospectus on AGGR, which is the SEC's massive electronic database, that digital act of filing is legally equivalent to physically delivering it to the client.
That's great.
The preceded or accompanied by mandate is instantly satisfied the moment the trade confirmation is generated, without a single atom of paper moving through the mail.
But the client isn't just left entirely in the dark, right? How do they know the document exists if they never receive a physical book?
The broker-dealer is required to send a notice to the purchaser stating that the sale was made pursuant to a registration statement and providing instructions on how they can request a physical paper copy if they genuinely want to read one. In practice, this notice is usually just a boilerplate line of text printed directly on the electronic trade confirmation they already receive.
All right, listener, red alert. This is a massive exam trap. Access equals delivery solves the paper problem for almost every standard equity and debt offering. There's one major corporate event where the SEC refuses to allow it. What is the exception?
Business combination transactions, mergers and acquisitions.
Let's break down the why there. Why does a standard IPO get to use Google Drive, but a merger requires killing trees?
Because the psychology and mechanics of the transaction are fundamentally different. In an IPO, an investor makes an active voluntary choice to hit the buy button. In a merger, an investor is often passively having their existing shares exchange for shares in a completely new combined corporate entity. The SEC mandates a shareholder vote for these combinations.
Oh, I see.
Because the investor is being forced to vote on fundamentally altering their investment, the SEC demands actual physical delivery of the prospectus, often acting as the proxy statement, before that vote takes place. Access equals delivery is strictly forbidden for mergers.
Write that down in bold ink. Mergers require physical paper before the vote. Now, access equals delivery handles the final prospectus. But let's rewind slightly and look at the preliminary prospectus, the red herring. Does Broker Bob have any lingering delivery duties with the red herring before he locks in a sale for his retail clients?
He does, but only in one specific scenario, an initial public offering. This is enforced through the broker-dealer 48-hour rule.
How does the clock work on this one?
If a broker-dealer is participating in an IPO, they're required to send a copy of the preliminary prospectus to any customer who is expected to receive a confirmation of sale, and they must ensure that document is sent at least 48 hours prior to the mailing of that confirmation.
So if Broker Bob has a client named Dave, and Bob knows Dave is getting an allocation of Frank's IPO shares, Bob has to guarantee Dave gets his hands on the red herring 2 full days before the deal prices and the final confirmation hits Dave's account. Why the 48-hour buffer?
It's a retail protection mechanism. Institutional investors have teams of analysts reading these documents for months. Retail investor Dave is at a massive information disadvantage.
True.
The 48-hour rule ensures Dave has a minimum of 2 days to sit on his couch, read the risk factors, and fully understand the unseasoned company he is buying into before he is legally locked into the trade.
Right.
But it is critical to remember this applies to IPOs only. Follow-on offerings for companies that are already trading publicly do not trigger this 48-hour preliminary delivery rule because the market is already pricing their existing stock.
All right, we have arrived at the final boss of the post-effective period. The bell has rung, the IPO is over. Frank's stock is officially trading in the secondary market. Does the requirement to deliver a prospectus simply vanish into thin air? Or do secondary market dealers, guys who had nothing to do with the IPO syndicate, do they still have to deliver the prospectus to new buyers who purchased the stock on the open exchange?
They absolutely still have a delivery obligation, but only for a highly specific window of time. This is governed by the Dealer Aftermarket Prospectus Delivery Rule. And I cannot stress this enough, the exam tests this relentlessly.
We better map it out.
You must build a mental map of the four different time periods, and more importantly, understand the logic behind why the days change.
Let's build that map right now. Scenario one, Frank the founder achieves his ultimate dream. His IPO is a massive, oversubscribed success, and he meets the stringent requirements to list his company on a national exchange, like the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange. How long do secondary market dealers have to keep delivering prospectuses to buyers?
25 days. For an IPO of an issuer whose securities will be listed on a national securities exchange, the aftermarket delivery period is 25 days from the effective date.
Let's look at the logic. Why 25 days?
Because national exchanges have massive listing standards. If you make it onto the NASDAQ, institutional analysts immediately start covering your stock.
Right.
Financial news networks talk about you.
It's highly visible.
Exactly. The market rapidly absorbs your information. The SEC believes that after 25 days, the market is fully saturated with the facts of the IPO, so the mandatory delivery period can end.
Okay, scenario two. Frank's IPO doesn't go quite as well. The financials are a bit shaky, and he fails to meet the NASDAQ listing requirements. The stock still goes public, but it trades exclusively on the over-the-counter market, the OTC, a non-listed IPO. What is the delivery period?
90 days.
That is a massive jump from 25 days to 90 days. Why?
Because the OTC market is the regulatory Wild West compared to the NASDAQ. Non-listed companies have less institutional coverage, less media scrutiny, and lower transparency. The SEC assumes it takes significantly longer for the baseline facts of an unlisted company to truly permeate the market and reach retail investors. Therefore, they mandate a 90-day shield of continuous prospectus delivery to protect those OTC buyers.
Scenario three, we aren't talking about Frank anymore. Let's look at a different company that went public a while ago, but they are a non-reporting issuer. They haven't been filing regular SEC reports, but they decide to do a follow-on offering to raise a new round of capital. What is the aftermarket delivery period?
40 days. The logic here is a middle ground. It's not an IPO, so the company isn't entirely unknown, which is why it's not 90 days.
Yeah.
But because they are non-reporting, there is an information vacuum that needs to be filled with the new prospectus, hence the 40-day requirement.
And finally, scenario four. Frank has been public for 2 years. He is a model citizen. He files his 10-Ks, his 10-Qs, and his 8-Ks exactly on time. He's a fully reporting issuer. He decides to do a follow-on offering to build that new factory. What is the aftermarket delivery period for his secondary market trades?
0 days. None. The regulatory duty vanishes immediately.
Because the information saturation is absolute.
Precisely. Frank is a reporting issuer. The market has been reading his audited financials every quarter for years. An aftermarket delivery period will be entirely redundant because the continuous disclosure system is already doing the heavy lifting.
Listener, you have to lock this memory map into your brain. Let's repeat it. Listed IPO, 25 days. Non-listed IPO, 90 days. Non-reporting follow-on, 40 days. Reporting follow-on, 0 days. Now let's test how well you understand the mechanics of those days with a direct question. Frank's company successfully lists on the NASDAQ. We know the aftermarket delivery period is 25 days. Let's say it is day 30. The 25-day window has officially expired. A retail client calls Broker Bob and says, I'm thinking about buying Frank's stock, but I want to read the IPO prospectus first. Can you send it to me? Does Bob have to provide it, even though the 25 days are over? Yes, he absolutely does.
This is a classic misdirection. The 25-day, 90-day, and 40-day rules dictate the automatic delivery requirement. During those windows, you must deliver it whether the client asks for it or not. But the broker's duty to deliver upon request never expires. If a client specifically asks for a prospectus, you must provide it, regardless of whether it's day 30, day 300, or 5 years later.
Which brings up a fascinating logistical problem. If a client requests a prospectus 2 years after the deal, the data inside that document is ancient history. Does the SEC allow companies to just hand out stale data indefinitely?
No, they don't. This triggers the stale prospectus rule. The SEC recognizes that a prospectus has a shelf life. The rule dictates that if a prospectus is used more than 9 months after its effective date, the financial information contained inside it cannot be more than 16 months old.
Let's do the math on that. If Frank's deal is a continuous offering, say he's selling shares slowly over the course of a year, once he crosses that 9-month threshold of continuous use, he has to look at the audited financials printed inside the document. If those financials are older than 16 months, the prospectus is legally stale.
And he must stop using it immediately. To continue the offering, Frank would have to file an updated prospectus, typically through a post-effective amendment, injecting fresh, current financial data into the document before he can hand it to another investor.
9 months of use, financials max 16 months old. Lock those numbers down.
All right, take a deep breath. We have dissected the entire life cycle of a registered offering, from the absolute silence of the pre-filing period to the 90-day of aftermarket tails. Let us do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute top testable takeaways from Function 5. I'll throw out the concept. You hit the listener with the hard rule. Ready?
Let's run it.
The pre-filing period. What is the baseline rule?
No offers. Oral or written. Complete and total silence regarding the stock.
The WKSI pre-filing safe harbor. Who gets the protection? The issuer only. It does not cover the underwriter. If Ursula pitches the hedge fund pre-filing, she's committing gun jumping.
A recorded roadshow sent privately via a password-protected Zoom link. What is it legally defined as?
It is a graphic communication, which means it is a written offer, which means it is a free writing prospectus. You must file it with the SEC by the date of first use.
What are the three non-negotiable mechanics of using an FWP?
It must contain the prescribed ADGR legend. It must be filed by the date of first use, and all parties must retain records of it for 3 years from the initial bona fide offering date.
The non-participating broker research safe harbor. What is the ultimate poison pill that kills the protection?
Compensation from any deal party. If Ursula or Frank slips broker Bob a single dollar, the safe harbor is dead and the report becomes an illegal prospectus.
Aftermarket delivery periods. Run the numbers.
25 days for listed IPOs. 90 days for non-listed IPOs. 40 days for non-reporting follow-ons. 0 days for reporting follow-ons.
And finally, the stale prospectus rule.
If the document is used past 9 months, the financial data inside cannot be more than 16 months old.
Outstanding. You know, we kicked off this deep dive by comparing the SEC's framework to a guy standing on a front lawn trying to sell a house with a megaphone. And when you step back and look at it, it's wild that the core philosophy driving these laws hasn't fundamentally changed since 1933, even though the technology has mutated beyond recognition.
It is the exact same regulatory paranoia, just wearing a modern disguise.
Yeah.
And that we have the perfect concept for listeners to chew on as they close their books today.
Yeah.
If the SEC rigidly considers a 280-character text-based tweet from an iPhone to be an illegal, non-conforming prospectus, extrapolate that logic into the future. Imagine how the enforcement division views a CEO doing a trending dance on TikTok, pointing to floating augmented reality bubbles that contain unverified forward-looking revenue projections.
Oh, man. Frank, the founder on TikTok, is Ursula's actual nightmare.
But the law treats it exactly the same. The format shifts. The technology evolves from newspaper print to video streams. But the statutory definition of an offer remains incredibly broad and totally unforgiving. Whether you are taking out a full-page ad in a 1934 newspaper or going live on a social platform in 2026, if you are conditioning the market before the facts are officially filed, you are breaking the law.
So keep Frank off TikTok, keep Ursula's blood pressure under control, and keep yourselves studying the logic, not just the numbers. You have the entire communications framework locked in now. Good luck on the Series 24, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.